You know, every once in a while, a new book comes along that hits us in the gut, helps us see the world differently. Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow is that book. It is a devastating argument that the drug war has destroyed a whole generation of young black men. Steve Paulson got a chance to talk to Michelle Alexander. So who is she, Steve?
Well, Jim, she doesn't have the kind of resume you would associate with someone who's become a kind of insurgent activist. Michelle Alexander went to Stanford Law School. She clerked at the U.S. Supreme Court, and she became a law professor. But there is a personal story here.
Well, tell me the story.
Well, Michelle Alexander was running the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU in California, working on a campaign against racial profiling by the police. And a young black man from Oakland came into her office, a drug felon, and he said he was innocent. He'd only taken the plea deal because they had threatened to lock him up for years. And she said, sorry, she couldn't help a drug felon. So he became enraged and told her, you are no better than the police. And he said, good luck finding one young black man in my neighborhood that they hadn't gotten to yet. And he stormed out of her office.
Uh-huh.
Michelle Alexander describes that experience as her awakening, and later she learned that this man was in fact innocent, that some Oakland police officers had planted drugs on suspects. So she started doing all kinds of research on the massive numbers of black men who've gone to prison on drug charges, and what she learned, she says, blew her mind.
Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination that we associate with the Jim Crow era are suddenly legal again. For the rest of your life, you've got to check that box. You know, asking the dreaded question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And it's on employment applications for the rest of your life. It doesn't matter if your felony happened a few weeks ago or decades ago. For the rest of your life, you've got to check that box, knowing full well your application is going straight to the trash. Employment discrimination is legal. Housing discrimination against you is legal if you have a criminal record. Under federal law, you're deemed ineligible for food stamps for the rest of your life if you've been convicted of a drug felony. And then to make matters worse, if you're lucky enough to get a job, or even if you're not, you find that when you're released from prison, you're saddled with hundreds or thousands of dollars of fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support. In a growing number of states, you're expected to pay back the costs of your imprisonment. And paying back all these fees, fines, and court costs may be a condition of your probation or parole. There are a web of rules, laws, policies, and practices that operate to lock people into a permanent second-class status following their release from prison, a second-class status that operates like a caste system, which is why I now believe that our system of mass incarceration operates more like a system of racial and social control than a system of crime prevention and control.
That is a very strong charge here. I mean, to make that equation between the Jim Crow era, I mean, legalized segregation, legalized discrimination, and what we're seeing now with the mass incarceration of black men?
Well, there was a time, you know, when I would have rejected that kind of talk out of hand. You know, there was a time when I rejected comparisons between mass incarceration and slavery and mass incarceration and Jim Crow. And I actually thought that people who made those kinds of claims and those kinds of comparisons were doing more harm than good, you know, to efforts to reform our criminal justice system and achieve greater racial equality in the United States. But I see things quite differently now. And I think when you take a step back, a big step back, and view our criminal justice system, not in a piecemeal fashion, asking, well, are these sets of police practices fair? Does it make sense for this particular policy, like felon disenfranchisement, to exist or not? You take a big step back and look what we've done over the last 30 years. We have quintupled our prison population. We went from a prison population in the 1970s of about 300,000 to now one of well over 2 million.
Which is the highest percentage in the world.
We have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, a penal system unprecedented in world history.
Let me return to the crimes that that these people have been charged with. I mean, the reason why so many black men in particular are in prison now, are you saying that they shouldn't be in prison, that the crimes are not, that the offense really was not that serious?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First, when we talk about drugs, drug crimes, the research has shown, studies have shown consistently now for decades that contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. You know, that defies basic racial stereotypes about who drug dealers are. We've been conditioned over the years to think of drug dealers as young black kids standing on the street corner with their pants sagging. And plenty of drug dealing does happen in the hood, but it happens everywhere else in America as well. Drug markets, much like American society generally, are fairly segregated by race. White folks tend to sell drugs to whites, blacks to blacks, even segregated by class. You know, university students sell drugs to each other.
But presumably the rules apply equally. I mean, you know, just as a white kid selling drugs, I mean, if he's caught, he's going to go to prison just as the poor black kid will.
Yes, but the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color. In fact, in some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been one race, African American. The extent to which the drug war has driven the mass incarceration of poor people of color is difficult to overstate. You know, drug convictions alone, just drug convictions, accounted for about two-thirds of the increase in the federal prison system and more than half of the increase in the state prison system between 1985 and 2000, the period of the prison system's most dramatic expansion.
You know, so you're saying that the war on drugs has dramatically changed the life of a huge percentage of African Americans.
It has radically altered the life course for particularly young black men. You know, what people don't realize, I think, is that when a young person is caught with some marijuana in their pocket or a little cocaine or whatever it is that young people find themselves experimenting with, young people of all colors find themselves experimenting with, but if a young person in the hood is caught with that, their life is over. They're now branded a criminal or a felon. They may be stripped of their right to vote for a period of years or the rest of their lives. They will be discriminated against for the rest of their lives in employment, housing, access to education, as well as public benefits. They're ushered into a parallel social universe in which the basic civil and human rights that apply to the rest of us no longer apply to them.
And yet I wouldn't call it the official rhetoric, but kind of the rhetoric of our country is that we now live in a colorblind society. We just elected a black man to be president.
Yes.
Are you saying that rhetoric has actually made things worse?
Well, you know, I think that there have been major gains that cannot, you know, be avoided or denied. I mean, the fact that we have a black president in the United States is extraordinary, something that's just unimaginable even 20 years ago. But at the same time, I think the acceptance of people like Barack Obama and the success, the extraordinary success of a relative few, have actually given us license to be indifferent to the suffering of all those left behind.
And sort of like, oh, if he could make it, any black man
could make it. It makes it easier to rationalize our indifference to the suffering of others. Can we say, yeah, well, if Barack Obama could be president of the United States, if a black man could be president of the United States, what excuse do you have, young man? The irony, of course, is that, you know, if Barack Obama had not been raised by white grandparents in Hawaii, raised by white mother in Kansas, if he hadn't done much of his illegal drug use.
And we know he smoked a lot of marijuana.
Yes, he's admitted to using cocaine as well,
yeah,
in his youth. You know, if he hadn't done most of his illegal drug use on predominantly white college campuses and universities, if he had been raised in the hood, the odds are very good. He would have been stopped. He would have been frisked. He would have been searched. He would have been caught. And far from being president of the United States today, he might not even have the right to vote, depending on what state he lives in. So I think rather than just resorting to the usual shaming and blaming, I think a little humility and a willingness to say, there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Well, it also strikes me that what you're saying challenges the civil rights movement as well. I mean, the civil rights establishment, which has been so focused on affirmative action in particular in recent decades, you know, in terms of, you know, making it easier for people of color to get into good schools, to get jobs. You're saying maybe there's a much bigger problem.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that those of us in the civil rights community have to acknowledge that we've allowed a human rights nightmare to occur on our watch. Why have we not risen to the challenge that this moment in history presents? You know, the civil rights lawyers, racial justice advocates have tried to distance themselves as much as possible from the criminal element. You know, the strategy of racial justice advocates have been to try to identify those Black folks that defy racial stereotypes and hold them up as examples of all that is wrong, irrational, and unjust about the prevailing caste system. After all, that's what I was doing as a civil rights lawyer, looking for my perfect plaintiff. You know, but challenging mass incarceration requires us, demands of us, to develop care, compassion, and concern for the guilty. There's just no way around it. So the strategy of looking for Rosa Parks, for looking for, you know, those individuals that are so obviously undeserving of our contempt and scorn and discrimination, isn't going to work this time. We are actually, if we're going to build a movement that ends mass incarceration, going to have to inspire Americans to believe that each and every one of us, no matter who we are or what we've done, are deserving of basic dignity, respect, and humanity. That's the challenge. As long as we imagine that the criminals are them and not us, and that we can lock them up, throw away a key, and not care much what happens to them after that, as long as we allow ourselves to live with that kind of indifference in our own hearts and our own minds, this system will continue to function well for a very, very long time.
Michelle Alexander talking with Steve Paulson about her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness.